Oh, Amazon, oh, Amazon, how stately grew your branches. Oh, Amazon, oh, Amazon, now gone to cattle ranches. We mow you down and wonder why the world is brown and hot and dry. My guitar is a Martin M36. People ask. It's got back and sides of Brazilian rosewood. A spruce top and ebony fingerboard. The bridge and the nut are of ivory. Pickguard's genuine tortoise shell. So here's a song about saving the planet.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this program, we're listening to Rediscovering Reinhold Niebuhr. Reinhold Niebuhr was an American theologian, ethicist, public intellectual, commentator on politics and public affairs, and professor at Union Theological Seminary for more than 30 years.
Not so long ago, even secular liberals recognized the biblical flavor of a lot of early American history. If you listen to an old Pete Seeger record, he'll have the word hallelujah used in the songs, or he'll sing a song about Jericho, even though he was a member of the Communist Party. It was just understood that that was part of our American heritage, and I'm not so sure that's the case today.
But I think that what's also revealed in just stepping back and taking a longer view of time is how 21st century liberals operate on some assumptions as though these are, you know, these are nuggets of wisdom that have come down across the ages. And in fact, there's a distance between them and what liberalism meant, at least as embodied in many people, including Reinhold Niebuhr, even in the mid-20th century.
That's right. If you think of what is considered the high point of American liberalism, I would say it has to be the Civil Rights Act of 1965. Mm-hmm. Here you had an activist Democratic president pushing through legislation that was going to make major social changes and expand freedom, which was the root of the liberal project. And at the same time, the Civil Rights Act was the culmination of the greatest religious episode in the history of this country,
right.
The civil rights movement as led by Dr. King. And with people like Niebuhr and Rabbi Heschel at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So those two causes at certain points in our history were one. And there are a lot of people in both the religious world and the liberal world who are saddened by the fact that those two movements have been torn asunder. I don't know what to do about it, but it's certainly true.
Mm-hmm. The words moral and immoral, those words are used and bandied about a lot in the early 21st century in U.S. politics and American life. I wonder if they mean it all the same thing when we use them and when Niebuhr used them. You have a really nice, concise sentence. The irony of American history, as Niebuhr explained it, is that our virtues and our vices are inextricably joined. I mean, that's also such an important point for him, isn't it? That morality and immorality are not these fixed, separate qualities that never meet.
I can't remember which ancient Christian sage said that good and evil are joined at the spine. Something like that, though. What Niebuhr meant is that we can't separate out our virtues and our vices. The very idealism that has animated so many good things in the history of this country also lead us to be arrogant, lead us to be insensitive to the cultures of other peoples, lead us to overestimate the ability to get things to go our way, and so on. Our virtues and our vices are inextricably joined. It's a religious insight that's being applied in a political situation.
I think one reason Niebuhr is intriguing to us now also is that he was such a bridge person, a crossover person between religious thinkers and actors and secular thinkers and actors.
I think that's true, and I was thinking about this over the past few days in connection with Niebuhr's insights about purity. His realism was grounded in his feeling that human nature is necessarily impure, and when you try to purify society, other people had better watch out, because that's when things get dangerous.
Right.
Whether it's reforming Christians who are trying to purify things, or reforming secularists who are trying to purify things. The Niebuhrian position would be religion never was altogether pure and never will be.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start from different premises.
Have you thought about how Niebuhr might react to the religiosity of our time, the way in which, you know, I'm saying that and I'm realizing that it was probably after he died that religion really retreated from the public sphere. And yet it's back out on the surface in many forms, and it's alarming to many intellectuals who I think are the same kinds of people we're talking about who would have found Niebuhr a very intriguing and helpful figure 50 years ago.
There was a lot of religious strife in Niebuhr's time as well, and it's easy to forget that, to assume that his time was one in which established religion had a comfortable place in the public life and religious figures could act without fear of reprisal, et cetera, and so forth. The religion was deep, historically committed.
Yeah.
The religiosity of the South was such that H.L. Mencken could sneer at it as the Bible Belt. Roman Catholics at the time were so distrustful of the public school system that they refused to send their children to it.
Yeah.
Certainly American Jews didn't suffer like the Jews of Europe, but this was not an altogether hospitable place for them. So my point is that in retrospect, it looks as though that was a solidly religious age, but these things are being contested in every age, and Niebuhr's gift was to not get stuck on that, to get on with his work without trying to fix the whole religious situation of America single-handedly.
Right, to be a constructive voice nevertheless.
And to write work that wasn't so rooted in his age that it couldn't transcend the age and speak to ours as well.
Paul Eli is a senior editor at Farrar, Straus & Giroux Publishers. This is Speaking of Faith. After a short break, we'll think about the insights Reinhold Niebuhr might have for the war in Iraq and the U.S. role in the emerging 21st century world. Welcome back to Speaking of Faith, Public Radio's conversation about religion, meaning, ethics, and ideas. I'm Krista Tippett. Today, Moral Man and Immoral Society. We're exploring the ideas and present-day resonance of the theologian and public intellectual Reinhold Niebuhr. He's recently been rediscovered by thinkers and politicians on the right and the left. For decades, one observer has noted, Reinhold Niebuhr defined how Americans with realistic faith would deal with the world. In his 1932 book, Moral Man and Immoral Society, Niebuhr applied his analysis of the human condition to societies and nations. Individuals, he said, may strive to be moral, but collectively human beings are compromised and prone to immorality, even evil. Niebuhr's complex reasoning about the world, God, and human nature made him hard to classify ideologically. He identified for many years as a pacifist, then vigorously argued for American engagement in World War II. He became a staunch Cold Warrior, but he rejected the war in Vietnam as an extension of that conflict. He once wrote that civilization depends upon the vigorous pursuit of the highest values by people who are intelligent enough to know that their values are qualified by their interests and corrupted by their prejudices.
Where has ever been a conflict in the human community where we have not felt that we could not fight the battle if the Lord were not on our side? Though, as Abraham Lincoln said, we did not frequently enough ask the question whether we were on the Lord's side. These are natural religious instincts, natural efforts to close the great structure of life's meaning prematurely.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Thank you.
answers. Look for God in life on distant planets. Have your faith in the ever after, while each of us holds inside the map to the labyrinth. Heaven's here on earth.
My next guest, the University of Chicago political theorist Jean Bethke Elstein, was an early proponent of U.S. military engagement in response to the September 11th terrorist attacks. In her 2003 book, Just War Against Terror, The Burden of American Power in a Violent World, Jean Bethke Elstein devoted a chapter to the father of just war theory, St. Augustine, together with Reinhold Niebuhr. I asked her in 2004 how she would characterize Niebuhr as a thinker with enduring wisdom on the reality and morality of war.
Well, what comes to mind is a person of great seriousness of purpose who ongoingly engaged the struggles of his time, didn't retreat from them, immersed himself fully in them without becoming entirely reconciled to them. So I think that insistence that we confront the harsh realities of our time, that we think seriously about them as Christians, that insistence is really the heart of the matter. And I would add here also the recognition that human beings are finite, incomplete, frail creatures, and that the politics that we create is bound to be marked by our own finitude.
So a great deal of what Niebuhr struggled with and the sort of crucible in which he formed a lot of his great theology had to do with world events and was in wartime.
Yes.
A very different kind of war and a different era of history. But I think what's maybe most interesting to get at is not so much asking where would Niebuhr come down on this current war, but how would he think it through? Now, you obviously have your opinions and positions, but, you know, I'd really like to start at getting at that. But how did you think about how Niebuhr would come at this, what ideas and questions he would bring to this current war that we have?
Well, he would certainly begin with those basic recognitions of human sinfulness, the reality of evil, the need to punish and restrain those who are determined to harm the innocent being those in no position to defend themselves. That, I think, would be the basis of his thinking, together with real concerns about trying to do more than you reasonably can, even in restraining and punishing evil. I think he would insist that evil be confronted, but at the same time that we not be overambitious in that confrontation and try to bring about results that are beyond our capacities, and thereby perhaps bringing about an outcome that is quite different from the one that we had too optimistically anticipated. So I think that he would approach this with a great deal of gravity and solemnity and recognition of the play of forces. I mean, it's, people, I think, forget that Niebuhr was very much in the mix of figures who were thinking about international relations and about how states behave.
Diplomats and politicians as well as religious thinkers.
Exactly. He's in that mix. Mm-hmm. And they're looking to him in part as one of their own, someone who brought a particular cluster of recognitions, but was very much a realist. So I must say that I go back and forth on how Niebuhr would finally situate himself. But I think that's how he would start to think about both the war against terrorism and the current Iraq conflict.
I mean, just a moment ago when you were describing his thought, I heard you using words and ideas that would be cautionary for people who take both sides of this war. I mean,
that's
on the
right.
One hand, that there is such a thing as evil that sometimes must be confronted, must be named and punished. On the other hand, that there's always this danger of hubris.
Indeed.
There's this great, well, I think this very compelling quote from Niebuhr. There are so many of them, aren't there?
There are.
He said, "The New Testament does not envisage a simple triumph of good over evil in history. It sees human history involved in the contradictions of sin to the end."
Absolutely. So how do you work out the tension? And it's a never-ending tension. It will persist
right
until the end time between power and the good, and how we try to make a world that is less brutal and less evil than the one that we're in, with no presupposition that there will be a culminating moment when all will be well.
Jean Bethke Elstein. Here's a segment from the Speaking of Faith archives with former war correspondent Chris Hedges. He described how Niebuhr's thought was shaping his attitude towards American military engagement in Iraq.
You know, Niebuhr is often described as a Christian realist, but he ardently opposed the Vietnam War. So I think Niebuhr understood human societies, and he understood human nature, And he understood that to make moral choice is not between moral and immoral, but between immoral and more immoral. And when you don't want to be tainted, and I think some pacifists can go this route in the same way that cynics do, you don't make choice. You know, because we live in a fallen world, because we often don't get to pick between good and evil, but between evil and more evil, you know, we in the end have to be tainted. It's why Niebuhr wrote that when we make a decision, because we don't know the will of God, we often don't know the consequences of our actions, however well-intentioned, we must always ask for forgiveness and be very frightened of hubris. And hubris, as the ancient Greeks know, can destroy us.
One of Niebuhr's favorite words, I think, or one of his central concepts was paradox. I mean, he used words like paradox and irony, and it seems to me that that falls away completely when you reduce everything to black and white, good and evil, and either or choice. Talk about how you understand and how he used and lived with a concept like paradox and how you might offer up that up to our public life.
Well, I think the paradox begins for a Christian theologian like Niebuhr with the fact that we have Christ and we have culture. That's the first paradox that his brother H. Richard Niebuhr wrote a famous book on Christ and culture. Christ's kingdom is not of this world, and yet Christians are called to try to achieve some relative justice, some approximation of that kingdom on this earth.
And part of that is also it's not a sense of futility, but just knowing that things will go wrong, being realistic.
Absolutely.
About that,
it's right? Being realistic, being aware of the shortcomings of what we can do, but that is not an invitation to quiescence or to a kind of sectarian retreat. That's an attitude that Niebuhr would find troubling, even offensive, because it neglects the responsibility that is ours to care for others. The question, you know, who is my brother, who is my sister, for Niebuhr is always a central moving question. So in the debate before the U.S. entry into World War II, which came belatedly as far as Niebuhr was concerned, one of the issues he was raising in the late 30s was, has no one any responsibility for the fact that the Nazis aimed to annihilate the Jews? He understood that was part of the Nazi agenda. Everybody who paid any attention knew that. Are they not our brothers and sisters, if you will? So I think that kind of engagement with the world in and through caritas, Christian love, translates as a kind of responsibility, then you have to figure out what you can reasonably be responsible for.
Here's something he wrote in Christianity and Crisis, which he wrote in 1952. But again, in the context of this remark is that he was extremely politically active. But he wrote,
indeed,
he wrote, religion is more frequently a source of confusion than of light in the political realm. The tendency to equate our political with our Christian convictions causes politics to generate idolatry.
He reminds us that politics, which is a good and which drew him to the point of exhaustion.
Yes.
If you read biographies of Niebuhr, he was just nonstop activist, if you will, on many, many fronts, and no doubt foreshortened his life, at least many believe that it did. But he was insistent that politics is not an ultimate value. It is a relative value. It is one good among many. And if we assume a kind of ultimacy in our politics, then that is, in fact, an idolatry, assuming a kind of perfectionist standard that can never be achieved.
Jean Bethke Elstein is Laura Spelman Rockefeller Professor of Social and Political Ethics at the University of Chicago Divinity School.
So long, Mom. I'm off to drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me. But while you swelter down there in your shelter, you can see me on your TV. While we're attacking frontally, watch Brinkley and Huntley, describing contrapuntally the cities we have lost. No need for you to miss a minute of the agonizing Holocaust. Yeah!
Little Johnny Jones, he was a U.S. pilot, and no shrinking violet was he. He was mighty proud when World War III was declared. He wasn't scared, no siree. And this is what he said on his way to Armageddon. So long, Mom, I'm off to drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me. But though I may roam, I'll come back to my home, although it may be a pile of debris. Remember, Mommy, I'm off to get a commie, so send me a salami and try to smile somehow. I'll look for you when the war is over, an hour and a half from now.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.